Hey, wonderfuls. Welcome to episode 352 of the JV Club with my wonderful guest, Alice Fraser. I am very, very pleased that we were able to record with one another from across the world. Boy, I really dragged that out. I want to acknowledge my wonderful friend and listener, Joseph, who was the very first person to suggest that Alice and I would get along. And it comes as no surprise to anyone that that is absolutely the case. I also want to just remind everyone that it is your last opportunity to sign up for the JV Gift Club 2019. Just as a final reminder to participate in the JV Gift Club book exchange, and we have a ton of people doing it already. I am so excited. I can't wait to hear what everyone sends everyone else. If you want to participate, just send an email to Chris, C-H-R-I-S, at ChristopherRoyce.com. That's Christopher, as you would normally spell it. Last name Royce, R-O-Y-C-E. One word, Chris at ChristopherRoyce.com by Friday. That's this Friday, December 6th, with your name and a mailing address. Boy, I really had to swallow. There was like so much information in that last sentence. I suddenly felt like I needed to swallow. You're going to pick up a copy, could be new, could be used, of one of your favorite books. If you go to a place and they're cheap and you find five different ones that are a dollar each, feel free to overwhelm your new pen pal friend with more than one, or just one, or that's it. I don't have anything else. And then you, so one of your favorite books when you were a teen, and then just make sure you calculate shipping costs when you shop, which usually costs a few bucks to send something. And then on Sunday, December 8th, this Sunday, you will receive a name and address to send your book to. So can't wait. As I have said, I always participate in this and I'm very excited to do so again this year. All right. Hope everyone's doing well and enjoy the episode.
So we're doing your podcast or my podcast?
I think we're doing my podcast.
Okay.
That's an adorable 2019 question. the notion that no one's sure which podcast is being done is kind of amazing.
Yeah, also the devastating feeling in the middle of an interesting conversation that you should be podcasting it. Oh. Nothing makes you feel like more like a piece of shit when you're like, this would make great content.
The
just
worst.
Just because you're connecting with someone.
Just the worst. What is that? I mean, I don't think of my, like, first of all, for us to both be able to say nothing makes you feel more shit than that is, I think, a testament to us not being shit. But like, what is that? Do you know what I mean? I mean, really? We just get so much pleasure from it that now it feels like something you want to sort of live on past the conversation itself.
Yeah, something like I occasionally do a thing in the UK, which is called Stand Up and Slam, which is stand-up comedians versus poets. And the joke struck me that often when the poetry is successful, they use, you know, in front of an audience, it's often funny. And so I think, you know, poetry is so, when it's good enough to be comedy, or comedy when it's so brilliant that it's almost poetry. There is something like that in terms of, like, if your podcast is interesting and good enough, it feels like a very natural conversation. And if your conversation is good enough, then it feels like it should be a podcast.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And I really quickly need to just dwell on the idea of, yeah, the stand up and slam, that. Those do seem like two things that would not draw the same audience. So I wonder if that would be if something like that exists in the States, and if
it's great because it doesn't draw the same audience. So you tend to get a poetry audience rather than a comedy audience, and I quite like that.
What about that? Do you like? Do you feel like they listen differently, or
they listen very differently? Yeah, it's a different vibe, and you're winning them over to a certain extent. Often people who are very into poetry might look down on comedy.
Sure. And vice versa.
Kind of a lesser art form. And I like that challenge.
Yeah. I wonder if poets feel the same way about stand-up. I mean, because that's, you know, the same can be said on the other way. There could be certainly people who have a deep appreciation of poetry and who feel like they also love stand-up. But I think, at least in the kind of alt comedy scene, there's a lot of snarkiness, right? So there's a lot of kind of, oh, those are authentic feelings, or those are words being used to express something genuine and vulnerable, which is ironic because the best stand-up kind of is that, right? But somehow, when you put under a different title, like, the guys become safer somehow to still sort of be like, yeah, but still no one can access my true feelings.
Because it's all jokes, you have that barrier of disclaimer-ness. But I think it also works in the other way with poetry, of the kind of veil of art, or, you know, this isn't utter self-indulgence because it's art. I wanted to be a poet. I wrote poetry when I was younger, and my mum was an incredible poet. But I went to poetry readings at university, and I was like, I don't want to be anything like any of these people. And then the comedy community, sure, it's still also full of degenerates, but at least they're not wanker degenerates. Like, at least they're not up themselves. That's such a terrible way to pick an art form. But
there's something, in general, I think there's something, like, do you feel like we live in an age where, like, being a part of the arts, that there's, you know, even just within the way arts express themselves and how sort of the word meta has become ubiquitous, that the way we approach being artists in this reality, in this time, in this Western culture, is like, has to have a sort of, like, potentially, like, a little bit of a shrug, or, like, you have to be a little bit of a wanker. Like, it, in the old days, was it like this? Were people like, ugh, you know, art schmart? Or were the distinctions between classes, or, you know, sort of jobs, métiers, and, you know, being the poet who has a benefactor? Like, I wonder if there was a sense of self-awareness the way there is now. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't know. I do think that now we have both, like, immense privileges and awareness of these kind of the breadth of society, like awareness of our own privilege as artists. And it makes us feel like art is a luxury.
Yeah.
And this is something I come back to, like, repeatedly, which is particularly in the way that governments do arts funding, for example. They treat it like it's a last on, first off kind of thing. It's the last thing you fund, and it's the first thing you cut when you're in trouble. And then I think about the fact that my granny was in the Holocaust, and, you know, hiding in a basement with her friends for, you know, to hide from the Nazis. They'd go out when the bombs were falling because it was safer for them to be outside when the bombs were falling than it was for them to be outside when the bombs weren't falling.
Yeah.
And they used to put on little plays for each other and do shadow puppetry on the walls, and it is I think it's one of the last things to go, actually, art, this need to kind of entertain ourselves and each other and connect with each other and distract ourselves from the truth, or engage with the truth in a way that is moderated enough that it's comprehensible and not just a primal scream.
Absolutely. And I will say, it takes a lot of cojones to disregard. I mean, listen, and I really don't mean, I'm doing the absolute opposite of belittling this, yet somehow what I'm about to say probably sounds still like I'm belittling it, but you really provided the mother of all defenses to in support of the arts. Like, it's very hard to, it would be, I just am hard pressed to imagine the person, and they absolutely exist. I mean, the Holocaust happened, so there you go. But just, you know, to sort of go, yeah, the Holocaust, like, trying to entertain yourself in the midst of, like, complete horror and still needing, like, love and imagination and light in some way, or the depiction of the horrible way you feel and getting it out of you, and that being this expression of art as well. When you put it like that, it's very hard to say, you know, oh, I don't know if it matters.
Yeah, and I think it clearly does. And part of what matters about it is that it is outside of everyday life. I sort of talk about this in my stand-up a little bit in my show Savage, which is art or is comedy particularly of all the art forms? Is it for turning your eyes away from hard things? Is it giving you a moment of like relief, looking complete triviality being important to take you away from the horrors? Or is it a way of kind of wading through the horrors and giving you some sort of, I don't know, armor or protective equipment or context or framework or structure of ideas that help you get through it? I don't know the answer. I think it might be both for different people in different times.
Thank God I haven't had to choose, because I feel that both have saved me at one point or another.
How did you get into comedy?
Oh, I just completely backwards, just couldn't have. I mean, I had to be cajoled and coaxed by friends of mine in the theater department at San Francisco State University. Just couldn't. I mean, I think the listeners of my podcast know, I think I think it was one of those things where I really loved acting, and I liked studying acting, and I liked also being the funny kid in the room. But certainly the idea of being tasked with doing that and in a way that was consistent and provable on some level was wildly intimidating to me, you know? So I couldn't have stubbornly resisted it more, considering the opportunities until, you know, my mid-20s, I think. And then I really just backed into it. I truly did. I was just kicking and screaming. What about you?
I loved comedy growing up, sort of the Monty Python and the Goon Show and that kind of British radio style comedy, the silly, clever comedy. I loved it.
Absolutely. But me too, as a fan, but couldn't cross over.
I was very bad at it the first time I tried it. I tried it at university improv, and I still remember the just full body prickling heat shame of how bad I was. And it was this odd thing of feeling like, you know, there were things that I was good at and I was told that I was talented at, and there was things that I was bad at and I just wouldn't do them. You know, lazy but talented, that was me. And I sort of thought, I know I'm bad at this. I wonder if I can get good at it and sort of if I can learn in that way. Like, I was sort of worried that I'd never be able to work hard at anything if it didn't come naturally to me. And so then I got addicted to that process of knowing I was bad, getting better, and then every thing you get, every laugh you get, every show you sell out, every happy audience member, every reward from the industry, you know exactly what you did to earn it. And it is so much more satisfying than this sort of ephemeral idea of, oh, you're talented. And of course, the things that I do have talent at, and I'm going to talk about that sentence in a second, the things that I do have talent at feed into my comedy. Like, I'm interested in stuff and I'm quite intense, you might have noticed. And they feed into my comedy, but just the process of making people laugh is such an interesting problem for me. Then it is infinitely difficult and infinitely engaging, and you can keep getting better at it and keep getting more skills. And the sentence that I wanted to like flag back there was saying that you're good at anything is completely unacceptable in Australia, and I'm only doing it because you're in America.
There's somehow we've escaped quite as much self-effacing.
Yeah, I don't know what it was, whether it was you rejected it with the British Empire or what, but
I think there's still a tremendous amount of apologizing and a tremendous amount of modesty, be it false or otherwise. But I think that was some. But you say that, but that was something that's still something I struggle with in certain circumstances, and it absolutely was something I struggled with my entire youth. I mean, I definitely was. I absolutely came up in the age of or the culture of, you know, if someone says you're good at something, you have to go, ugh, no, I'm awful. Oh, no, please don't. You are. Or, you know, and whether or not.
Well, because it's also because it's terrifying to be told that you're talented at something. What does that mean? Does that mean you have to do it? And if you're not successful, then you're a failure as a human being? Like, what? It's so crippling.
Yeah.
Ugh. Gross.
But I know, it's funny because I think I've told you that, you know, I've had a handful of people say, oh, you have to podcast Alice. Like, you guys, you know, you just would understand one another. And I just so recently, like in the last, I think, two episodes of my podcast, spent a fair amount of time. And it's a sort of sing-song theme for me, too, of this idea of being, of how awful it is in a very privileged way to be kind of okay or good at things naturally, so that everything that wasn't true for me had to belong to someone else. Like if I was not naturally good at it, I couldn't have shut it out faster, and I couldn't have dismissed it as like, that belongs to other people who are good at it.
Yeah.
And
a fascinating book for that. Can I recommend a book?
Oh, please.
Is Stephen Fry's The Ode Less Traveled. And that's about poetry. And it's basically a textbook on how to do poetry if you're not a poet. This idea that we have that if you're writing poetry, it has to be Keats or Shakespeare or Shelley, or, you know, that this idea that someone can pick up a guitar and play at a party and they're not the best guitar player, but it's nice and everyone enjoys it and you get pleasure out of it and they get pleasure from playing and people get pleasure from listening or singing along. I mean, not at all parties, not all guitars, hashtag. But the idea that it, you know, if somebody picks up a pen to write a sonnet, all of a sudden you're like, you know, you're shit. Why would you even do that? How could you even pretend to be good enough to allow yourself to write a fucking couplet? This idea is ridiculous. People can paint for pleasure. People can play an instrument for pleasure. But for some reason, indulging in words for pleasure is seen as wanky or foolish, or that you must think really highly of yourself rather than just enjoying it.
Yeah, that's true. There is a lack of playfulness with words that doesn't seem to have crossed over to many other sort of arts and crafts, I say, as a more, you know, as a sort of more... amateur, and I mean that in the nicest way, but you know, being sort of a dilettante at something like that, arts and that's sort of what I love about an arts and crafts fair. It's like as soon as you attach crafts to arts, suddenly it becomes very like homespun and very folksy, and you suddenly go from like, you know, suddenly you're like, you know what, there probably will be a few wooden geese in bonnets. Like, yeah, that's, and I'm okay with that. I'd like to see some quilts, you know, that there's some kind of permission that's given with the level of sophistication expected with various forms of the arts. And, you know, what's funny is that as you were talking about Stephen Fry's book, of course, I had to have like the most Hollywood comparison in my head, which was like, yeah, well, Save the Cat, you know, is this like very commercial book that tells you don't have to create this thing that's never been seen before. And so, you know, as much as it is about taking something beautiful and turning it into like what can be a blockbuster movie, and that's not lost on me, but it's the same principle, right? It's the same idea of needing to be told by someone else, please don't do a thing. Like, please don't stop yourself from doing a thing because you're afraid that it comes from somewhere, that you were inspired by something, that, you know, that you're copying, that you're plagiarizing, or that you're just going to bore everyone, because these stories that we want to be told time and time again, you know, the ones that are the most lasting and the ones that touch the most people tend to be these sort of tropes, you know, and that's okay. You just find a way to tell your version of something in a unique way, or in a way that's pleasing to people, right?
Yeah, and that there is also something in the effort or in the timestamp of it, doing something imperfectly, that is. You know how you sometimes see these kind of memes going around of someone who's done a drawing and it's a shitty drawing, looks goofy or mental in some way. I love those, and I don't love them in like an ironic way. I think they are, you know, you see the effort and you see the love and you see the intention and you see the lack of skill. The lack of skill combined with the effort is something like truly beautiful.
I think you just described Ed Wood's Plan 9 from Outer Space also. I don't know why I can't get away from movies, but that is well, another example of, I know, it's really, it's just kind of ingrained, But no, that's the same thing. It's this, you know, these things that are treasured, like that's just something I do a live staged reading of and on a fair, you know, like sort of a couple of times a year that Dana Gould has kind of written. He feels the same way that it's just this extraordinary, beautiful, wonderful, weird, bad thing that is coming from such a wonderful place of this passion for filmmaking. And I think, you know, there are things that you can watch. Like, I've never seen The Room, but that's, you know, an example of something where people say it's so terrible. It's kind of good, but I don't feel like there's affection there. It feels like there's some degrees removed from what makes it lovable, whereas a great bad movie or a great bad book or a great bad painting, to your point, you still feel like it's infused with something genuine and something real. And what could be more lovely than that expression by a human being, you know?
Yeah, I think it's there's a comedy room in England, and they do it in the Edinburgh Fringe and in London, called the ACMS, the Alternative Comedy Memorial Society. And you go up and you do something, and they're not interested in seeing you do something good. They're interested in you trying something or doing something that never works. At the end of every performance, the hosts come on and they say, a failure. And the audience says, a noble failure.
Oh, that's great.
And like, it's cheesy and everything, but that is, it's truly beautiful. You know, yeah. People get up and they do just the weirdest stuff. You know, I saw Tim Fitzhyam do his whole set in Semaphore, because he knows Semaphore for some reason.
Wow.
With the flags. It's not funny. It doesn't work. But
right.
It's amazing. It's amazing to see someone try something like that.
Absolutely.
You know, I love it so much.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I will be back after a word from our wonderful buddies at Maximum Fun.
We interrupt the podcast you're listening to tell you about another podcast. That's right. We Got This with Mark and Hal.
That's correct, Mark. This is Hal. We do the hard work for you, settling all of the meaningless arguments you have with your friends.
So tune in every week on the Maximum Fun Network for We Got This with Mark and Hal, and all your questions will be asked and answered.
You're welcome.
All right, that's enough of that.
We got this.
And so you said that you came into the comedy side of things in college. What were you like as an adolescent? What were your sort of middle school, high school years like?
So we have sort of two schools. We have primary school and then we have high school. So primary school goes up to about the age of 11, and then high school goes up until the age of 16, 17. And in primary school, I had a nice time. I was there with my twin brother, and, you know, we kind of formed a little gang against the world. He and I and a girl called Annie Jolliffe, who played the drums, and a boy called Mike, who was a bit, you know, a bit fey and a bit effete. And so we were sort of outside the boys' group and the girls' group. Mm. And then I went to high school and was very badly bullied. And very much an outsider, and too proud to kind of try and crawl my way back in. It was an all-girls school, so sort of that toxicity was not something that I could negotiate very well. I used to skip out of class and go and read in the library, or skip out of school entirely and go to a local bookshop, and I just buried myself in bad fantasy novels and sci-fi. And then I got to university and kind of really hit my stride, I think. I felt like it was an amazing thing. I've told this story before on my own podcast, but it was in first year university. I went to some party at the university bar, and people were talking, and I was sort of there on the fringes of things. And the party officially ended, and a guy called Andrew Garrick said, hey, we're going to a drink. Do you want to come along? And I was like, oh, yeah, no, I'm just heading home. And he said, no, you seem like an interesting person. And I just thought, oh, my God, they don't know.
I could be anyone.
I'm the weird freak,
I could be anything, yeah.
they don't know that I'm completely unlikable and horrible and all of that. And it genuinely, that one thing changed the course of my life and my whole idea of myself. So I will always be grateful to Andrew Garrick for, I have no idea why, whether he was being nice or whether he did think I was an interesting person or what, but for that, I will forever be grateful.
It is really amazing when people have those actual sort of watermark moments or those, you know, those landmarks where you can actually say this precise moment. I mean, I have a couple of kind of, you know, like sort of phases that I, you know, even if short lived, that I can kind of point to and say, wow, I really think that changed the course of things. But I don't know that I have an Andrew Garrick moment. I don't know that I have that sort of, the world cracks open and it's you know, suddenly a different color or whatever. That's pretty extraordinary. When you have a moment like that, do you think that for people who do you think that they spend more time, not to say that you just sit navel gazing, but do you spend more time kind of contemplating what would have happened if not?
I don't know. I think, yeah, I don't know. I know there are choices that I've made in my life that were the wrong choice. And I'm very, very easily paralyzed by choice. I'm about to go back to London from Sydney, where I am now. I spent a month here, and I'm going back for 3 months, maybe four. And then I'll be back here for the festivals, and then I'll be going back there. But any time I leave either of those countries or any country for any extended period of time, I have a week of just being filled with utter dread that there's an alternate timeline version of myself that I am murdering by virtue of getting on a plane, and it's not a good quality in myself, and it leans me towards inaction rather than action, which is probably to do with, you know, my childhood and all that. But yeah, I'm very easily frozen or crippled by choice.
Yeah, I relate to that. I mean, I definitely think, this is just so, constantly refer to past episodes of our mutual podcast or experience. But yeah, I think there are times in my life where I was just uncomfortably aware that a choice had to be made for me, because there was because otherwise I just wouldn't have changed something that you know, that just needed to be changed. But I think it's interesting that you continue to make that choice, right? I mean, it's one thing to say, you know, that's not my best quality, but at the end of the day, you are doing it. You're not, you know what I mean? Most people would say, oh, I don't know how I could do that. I don't even know how I could bop back and forth between two wildly different countries, you know, at the end of the day, and be across the world. And that's a huge leap to become familiar with or comfortable with on any level, whether it, you know, whether you have like some feelings about that are complicated. Boy, you're still making that choice every time. That's huge.
Yes and no. Like, I've got gigs booked in, so I have to be there. So the choice is out of my hands in that way.
Yeah, but you know, again, I know this so well. You've still engineered your life. You know, you could simply say, like, no, I just work here now. Whatever that's going to mean, I just work here, you know?
Yeah, it's a trolley problem sort of thing. It's a psychological thing as much as it is anything else. Like, I don't want to press the button, but if someone else asks me to press the button, I'll do it.
You like, will kill those other people or the kid on the tracks or whatever that problem is.
Yeah, I mean, they do that with drone pilots, you know? They had them selecting targets and firing, and they got really bad sort of psychological issues. But now they have a robot voice tell them when to fire, and then they don't get as much damage. I mean, they obviously get incredibly damaged. It's a terrible thing to do, to spend your 9 to 5 shooting people and then go home to your family.
Yeah.
Like, it's worse, I imagine, in some ways than being in a war zone, because you're switching modalities so quickly.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I think it's I don't know. I had this insight today, so it seems more interesting to me than it probably is. But my mum was.
You haven't let it get stale yet.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't realized how boring it is as an insight. But my mum was sick when I was growing up. And so if we were loud or disruptive or did things that we wanted to do that caused difficulty, she would have health effects, consequences for that. Whereas if you didn't do anything, if you just sneaked off and did your thing quietly and didn't disturb anybody, then if she got sicker, it wasn't your fault.
Sure.
I think that might be deeply wired into my psyche.
Oh, God,
and
I'm
explain
sure.
why I'm very bad at quitting jobs or breaking up with people.
Yeah. No, that's huge. I mean, that's sort of should be in a textbook if it's not. But that the idea of feeling, because, you know, we all sort of, I think most of us understand, because it's just part of the zeitgeist still, that feeling like we cause things in our parents' behavior is just one of the biggies. It's one of the biggies, you know. Yeah. So that's huge. But having a twin brother, and I won't dwell on this too much, because I know that twins are fascinating to people who aren't twins, and it's probably extremely tiresome to anyone who is a twin. But first of all, in my life, certainly much rarer fraternal twins of different sexes, right? I don't know if that's rarer, but incidentally, if not, I'm trying to think of any twins I've known who weren't identical. To be honest with you, I think I've only drawn identical twins to my life. But I think obviously that's a different, I think that must be a different, everybody has a different, you know, a different relationship, regardless of whether you're an identical twin or a fraternal, but I think that closeness, did you sort of have each other as a sounding board to at least express whatever version of that feeling you had? You know what I mean? Like, yes, you don't have the presence of mind now to go, oh, you know, at the time you weren't like, oh, wait a minute, I think I see what's happening. When, you know, when my mom's sick, it's my fault. Therefore, I will X, Y, Z, that there are probably a lot of ways that that's happening that you're not identifying. Could you talk about that with your brother at the time a little bit in some child way?
Oh, that's interesting. No, I don't think we ever did talk about it, because mum was sick from when we were born. So it was kind of just the game. It was the life. It wasn't something that we thought about or talked about as though it were, you know, anything unusual. It was just life. But we did, I mean, we brought each other up. We looked after each other. My brother is probably he's probably the best man I know. And it wasn't until we were a lot older that we started talking about it. And even so, you know, he doesn't particularly like me doing comedy that mentions it. Mm. Because in part, I wrote a poem about it, but our family is very careful of each other's feelings, and maybe too careful, because things were so hard at various times that, you know, we didn't have a teenage rebellion. When my mum died, I realized that I had never said anything cruel to her. I certainly couldn't remember ever having said anything cruel to her, because we knew she was dying our whole lives, you know. So we are very delicate with each other, and I think that can lead to problems sort of percolating away in the underground that may have to be dealt with later. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my brother is great. He thinks about things very deeply, and he's very like Hamlet. He's doing it. He's the primary carer for his now 1-year-old daughter, and he's just started talking about it. And I'm so happy, because he's a very private guy. I'm so happy to see him kind of branching into my world a little bit. He's got a YouTube channel and podcast called the Man Mum Podcast, where he's kind of just talking about all these interesting things, like the physical setup of men who have primary care responsibilities. Like, it fucks their backs, because they're not built to carry a baby for 12 hours a day. in this really, like, this is something that you don't really think about.
Well, and worse, I feel like you have the sort of the masculine mystique fitting into it, right? Where it's like, I can't talk about this. I'm a man. The last thing I can acknowledge is that I can carry less weight than a woman.
Yeah. Yeah. That this hurts me more than it would, even though I'm physically stronger. I don't have a hip. I don't have a hip. I can't put a baby on a hip. So
right.
my neck's really sore.
I mean, obviously that sort of stands out as I'm an only child, right? So if I choose to tell my story, there are fewer people whose story I'm also telling incidentally, you know?
Yes.
So for me, it is hard to imagine having a sibling, much less a sibling the same age, to where, you know, obviously you're having your own unique individual experience, particularly when we get to talking, you know, about your high school experience where day in and day out, you were surrounded by girls and he wasn't there and you weren't having that experience together. But yeah, like sort of drawing the line, like, at what point, if you're careful about his feelings, what kind of conversations do you have, if any, about at the beginning of your of doing comedy? Like, oh, by the way, I'm probably going to be telling a lot of stories about our life.
Yeah,
I hope you're okay with it.
Yeah, well, I don't talk about him on stage. He's specifically asked me not to. Talk about him on stage, and particularly with Savage, which my dad could see as a work of art and enjoy as a work of art. You know, he said that's a very good piece of art, and he understood that it wasn't me trying to tell the whole story. I was trying to make a specific point. But I think for Henry it was very difficult because my story was so closely aligned with his that me editing things out or choosing what I did, a very razor-thin slice of the experience. The challenge for me artistically was to tell as little as possible while still communicating the kind of emotional reality of this particular situation or this one event that happened in the course of this whole life. For me, that was the interesting thing, but I think for him it felt like I was taking control of this narrative, and the story that is told in public is the story that kind of defines the thing retrospectively. Right. We had that discussion, which is about as close as we come to a fight. A friend of mine once said, watching you fight is hilarious because you just stand and you both stare off in slightly different directions and look really disappointed that it's come to this. Which is a brutal indictment of the way my family discusses things.
Well, first of all, what brought about, was it known that you were going to always go to a private girls' school for high school, or was that a decision that was made for you since you maybe didn't like to make decisions? How did that come about?
It was not a private girls' school, so it was what we call
public selective. Oh, I'm sorry, I totally threw that in.
Oh, yeah, I understand it. So in our school system, we have public schools, we have private schools, and we have what are called, we have Catholic schools, we have also what are called public selectives. Mm. So they're government funded, you don't pay school fees, but there's a test to get into them. So you have to pass a test. And I think, you know, we looked at the brochure and I got in and I thought it would be good. And it wasn't.
Yeah.
And I should have, I think that the mistake I made there was not going to that school. It was when in year 10 it became really evident that I was not having a good time. I was really miserable and everything was bad and Mum wasn't well and all of that fed into it. But Dad said, would you like to leave that school and go to another? And I thought that it would be as bad anywhere else. I thought it was sort of that I was the problem and that I was inherently unlikable. So I said, no, I'll stay. And I think that was maybe the first bad non-choice that I made in my life.
Mm. Well, that's a hard... Once that voice takes hold, boy, that's a very powerful thing to have to combat, this self-created thing for the most, you know, for the most... but obviously, if you have people treating you like, in what ways were you bullied? Was it overt? Was it passive? Was it, you know, being ignored? Was it all of the above?
It was all of the above. I mean, girls' schools have that thing of in high school and in your adolescent years, people are exploring their power over other people and their place in the world and their control over things like status. and the ways in which girls do that, particularly in all girls' environments, are very psychological, often subtle, sort of stonewalling or spreading rumours or pouring chocolate milk into your locker or capers into your bag or, you know, smells. And, you know, there wasn't punching, but there was sort of...
Humiliation.
Humiliation and degradation and chipping away at your sense of reality.
Denying
things that had happened or...
Gaslighting, it's true.
Yeah, gaslighting.
It's so hard.
En masse in groups. Girls in girls' schools can be just utter cunts.
Well, let me tell you, it's certainly true in co-ed schools, co-ed public schools as well, because that was... I so relate to this feeling of just surreality of just like, where have I gone that this dimension exists where everything looks the same, but these people are not my friend today. Like what has happened? The sort of depersonalization of that, which kind of suggests maybe that is why I went crazy temporarily in college, but I shouldn't say that lightly, but certainly when I started having like my own version of a panic attack, it was extremely surreal. But the feeling of let me ask you this. Do you feel like you have, you know, there are some, just speaking as for women for the time being, do you feel that you are somebody who identifies those kinds of behaviors or some sort of feeling of wariness? Do you feel like that's spread equally, whether there's a ton or none, across men and women for you? Or do you feel like because of those experiences, you are more wary of women? Because there are some women, right, who have great relationships with other women and pick bad men. If they're straight.
Yes. I have now very good relationships with women. I have some very close friends and that kind of passionate female friendship that I think is so wonderful and so important.
And you may not know it with the same intensity if you hadn't experienced the opposite, right?
Yeah. When I met, and it was in university really, when I met women who I just liked me and valued me, and you just fall in love with them and you want to hang out all the time and do things together, and they see you and they understand you and you see them and you understand them, and they're just so beautiful and incredible and talented, and you have that real thing. I think I valued that very highly, and I still have those friendships in my life, and they shaped, I think, my self-esteem in a way that male attention hasn't done.
Mm.
I think that, you know, I have a very, very good father and a very, very good brother. So I like men and I don't tend to be afraid of men particularly, even though I've had sort of bad experiences with scary creeps. But yeah, I think there is something particularly special about female friendship that we don't talk about enough, maybe. Like I think particularly in the American public discourse, which of course pervades Australian, you know, your cultural imperialism is very effective. there is an idea of friendship between women that's all about like brunch and shopping and, oh my God, you look amazing stuff. But just sitting down and really talking about intense feelings with someone who you feel safe with. For me, that happens, I think, with my female friends in a way that it doesn't with my male friends.
That makes sense. And you're right. There's a sort of superficial, like cupcake frosting version of female friendship as depicted in almost
God,
all
I
popular.
Loathe cupcakes. I loathe cupcakes. That's the perfect.
And I wasn't even giving you the
metaphor.
Cupcake. I made you just have the frosting. So that's really mean.
Like cupcakes as this idea, you know, oh, it's not, just have a fucking slice of cake. It doesn't need to be pretty. Like it doesn't need to be this like, yeah, sorry. Just hit me on a cupcake nerve.
I'm glad that I feel I very much picked the right object to then project all of that stuff onto, because it feels like it it does a good job as a physical representation in this moment.
Yeah, if you want to eat a piece of cake, eat a piece of cake. Don't make it a metaphorical vagina with flowers on. Just have the cake.
I wonder how many women who would hear that and just go, I really think I just like cupcakes. I think I might just like cupcakes, Alice.
No, they're bland. They're sickly sweet on top and bland in the middle. They're deeply upsetting.
Oh, it's time for a quick break. I will be back after a word from our friends at Maximum Fun.
I'm Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
And together, we host a podcast called Still Buffering, where we answer questions like,
why should I not fall asleep first at a slumber party?
How do I be fleek? Is it okay to break up with someone using emojis?
And sometimes we talk about butts.
No, we don't. Nope.
Find out the answers to these important questions and many more on Still Buffering, a sister's guide to teens through the ages.
I am a teenager.
And I was too. Butts, 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 butts.
No. Will you change your mind?
So this game, this MASH game is, as far as I know, quintessentially American, or at least limited to America. I could be dead wrong. If you or anyone outside of the
I've
States
not heard of it, but I do hate fun. So.
Okay, good. Well, you are going to love this because I will insist on three examples of fun for a series of categories. So get ready to get angry. So this MASH game, MASH, it's you would do it on a little piece of paper. In my case, I have a cute little pad that a listener made for me and sent to me many years ago. I now have to get them printed because I've become terribly spoiled. Mansion, excellent. Apartment, shack, and house is what MASH stands for. That's baked into the game, but it is a game about wishes and dreams and imaginings. And so I'm going to give you the categories, and then you give me your sort of your ideal answers, and then we'll just do this little thing where in the end I will have narrowed down one per category, and then I will give you your kind of alternate universe MASH life.
Okay.
So that's what we're after. So because on the topic of cupcakes, I'm going to start with one of my perennial favorite categories, which is in this alternate universe, you can have any food that you want. There's nothing that's going to make you feel sick about it later. There's nothing that's, you know, sort of ecologically improper about it. And it can also be something that you've had once, you know, or there's this perfect, like, there's this perfect, I'm going to say cupcake. There's this perfect cupcake at this one shop in Paris. And I've never been able to find its equal. So it could be as simple as pizza, but we're creating this alternate universe where you can have whatever you want, food-wise, three things that you would love to have in perpetuity at the snap of your fingers with zero ramifications.
Japanese, like really good, wholesome Japanese food with like salmon, teriyaki salmon or something on those, that would be one.
Great.
Mangoes in mango season.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely.
It's always going to be mango season if you end up with mangoes at the end of this.
Oh, mangoes. Like good, proper Kensington Pride mangoes, not these weird ones that have been bred to like have a shelf life. Mangoes that you can't eat without getting them up to your eyeballs, that kind of mango. And it's more of a meal than it is a specific food. It's green tea at Taka Tea, which is like they make this incredible green tea, like the best quality, and it comes with these little peas, crunchy peas, and red bean, sweet red bean, and it's served to you by Taka, who is this old Japanese man, and he's so chill and so nice and so shy, and he just sort of potters around in the background while you drink tea and have a conversation with someone. He dusts things in the background. It just makes it perfect.
Where is this?
It's in Double Bay in Sydney.
And, okay.
the best place in the world.
Ugh. I wish I'd known about it 5 years ago when I was in Sydney.
next time I'll take you.
Okay, good. Okay, next category is three books that you can jump into whenever you want. You're not reliving the plot. You're not one of the characters. It's just an opportunity to go and sink into those worlds whenever you want. And for however brief a time you want.
Venetia by Georgette Heyer, which is a romance novel, but it's so much more than that. The Lord Peter Wimsey series of detective novels by Dorothy L. Sayers.
This sounds like something I need to get on immediately based on name alone.
Yeah, she's brilliant. Really, 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 really brilliant. And The 13 Clocks by James Thurber, which is a children's book, but is one of the best books to read aloud.
No but accepted. I won't accept the but. I'm happy for it to be a children's book. No qualifiers necessary. Okay, next question. Give me three, let's say in your, wherever you dwell, because I know that you're back and forth a lot, but imagine one of the places that you find yourself in often, and within this apartment or house, there's a magical room. So, you know, you go through the door and it's as big or as small as you need it to be, and provides whatever wonderful hidden thing that you might want from this magical room in your house.
Okay, so the house that I grew up in was this falling down sort of old mansion come boarding house, and it was full of wild people. The front room had a bay window that looked out over Sydney Harbour and a big garden with a tree outside. And the bay windows had sort of stained glass panels at the top, so the light that came through them was coloured. And the tree outside was a jacaranda, which is a very particular colour, sort of a purple colour with very green leaves.
Alice, you'll be pleased to know I'm sitting maybe 6 feet away from a jacaranda in my backyard.
Such an incredible colour. And then there was a flame tree next to it. And then you'd look out over the harbour with the lights sparking sort of blue and gold off the water, or on a grey day, this beautiful, soft, sort of silvery dove colour. Mm. That for sitting and reading or jumping
wonderful
out the window. Secondly, some sort of attic room in a tower.
Wonderful.
With books around, lots of books, and those ladders that you can go up to get books.
Have you ever read The Velvet Room, speaking of children's books?
No, I've not.
There's a book called The Velvet Room by Zilpha Keatley Snyder. She was really kind of the go-to authoress for me when I was younger. She did such an amazing job of creating these little secret, wonderful places that were kind of like magic adjacent. There was a sense of magical realism, but there absolutely was nothing magical about it other than just the wonder that a child has about a thing. She has this other book called The Egypt Game, which is about these kids who are very different from one another, but who end up creating this sort of this worship of ancient Egypt in this kind of crummy backyard that someone has, and they build, you know, they sort of build out this world. But The Velvet Room, I think, takes place kind of during the Dust Bowl, and there's a little girl who is traveling around with her family as they look for work, and she ends up in this place where she ends up being entrusted. I always think about how her little dirty bare feet are described. She's entrusted with this key to this room in this mansion, and she calls it the Velvet Room, and it's just a sort of a tower that's essentially a library, where she just gets to sit and read and tuck her little dirty feet under her as she sits on the window seat. I feel like that might be about you.
Quite possibly. I used to read in trees till I fell asleep.
Well, there you go.
I think the third thing would be a boat. The third room would be some sort of boat.
That's an exciting twist. I like it. Okay,
you know,
great.
Little sort of canal boats where everything folds away.
Beautiful. Okay, next category. This is checking off the standard box we have here in our MASH game of romance. So in this alternate universe, it can be a character from a book. It could be a character in a movie. It could be the actor or actress who plays that person. Anyone from any period of time. So it could be, you know, Jimmy Stewart circa 1950, whatever you want.
Mm-hmm. And it has to be three or just the one?
Three, and you'll end up with one.
Okay. Oh, I mean, what you want is one of those sort of honorable, tormented men who, like, desperately want you, but they're too honorable to make a move because they have some, you know, position of either subservience or dominance that they don't want to take advantage of.
I'm hearing Jane Austen.
You're probably Jane Austen or something along those lines, or sort of like that, more like maybe slightly more purple fantasy thing where they're like the general of your army and you're the princess, or, you know, they've rescued you from something and they're your mentor in some sort of battle situation and they have to look after you, but then you have to look after them, and the tormented honorable thing, I think,
I
is
love
probably
it.
Is that a kink? I don't know.
I think it's certainly a relatable one if it is. Okay, all I had room for on my little line was tormented, but we both know what that means if we come back to
it. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Type two, or as specific or as general as you like for the other two.
Type two would be, let me think, the charming rogue. So the dishonorable one who you redeem by virtue of your great rank.
I don't feel like you've picked, I mean, I guess the charming rake could be funny. But charming doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you could laugh
funny,
till milk snorted
no,
out
never,
of your nose.
Yeah, no, I don't know if funny is the thing for me. I've known too many comedians, perhaps.
Well, exactly. I could see it being something that's at the top of the list, or something that is never going to make the list.
Well, certainly maybe the artist.
Okay.
Like the person who's just passionate about their art and is excellent at something, and that kind of ineffable quality where they're just beyond you, so incredibly good at something, and you just love watching them.
Wonderful.
And then for some reason they like you.
Uh-oh.
As well.
Mm-mm. The reason is that you're you, so we'll
yes.
stop that right now. Okay, next category. Let's do three places in the world that you would like to have a little vacation home. If getting there, let's assume that getting there takes no time at all. So we're sort of teleporting. Everything is equal.
Three places in the world that I would like to have Sydney.
Great.
On the cliffs at Diamond Bay, looking out over the ocean. London, middle of the city, Soho. And Inle Lake in Burma, in Myanmar now, which is a city on a lake. People live in these bamboo huts that poke out of the water.
Oh, sure. I feel I've only seen pictures, but pictures I have seen.
It's pretty wild.
Okay, next category. Let's do three skills that you would like to wake up with tomorrow without having had to master. Now, this goes right into our problem of the lazy talent, but let's say you've earned it. You've earned it not to have to be perfect. Great, great.
I would like to be able to understand music. I can play music, but mainly only by ear. And that means that I don't have the technical, you know, how people can just write it because they know the maths of it. I'd like to do
Same.
Have that.
Same.
Because I think that would be super interesting, and it would give you, you know, other than just, oh, it sounds great, you'd be able to figure out why.
Absolutely. Well said.
I'd like to be an incredible singer with one of those just like wild voices.
Great.
That just, and I would like to be able to dance.
Wonderful.
Like properly, like those where they're kind of in the air and their body is like a full circle.
Yeah. This sort of lack of gravity dancing is very attractive to me.
Sergei Polunin, have you seen that video of him dancing?
Oh, yes.
Like a warehouse?
Yes. Yes.
Wild.
You really do. You think you must have a different relationship to the Earth's gravity than I do. Like, there's no way that you don't, you lucky bastard.
Exactly. Exactly that.
Okay, let's do alternate universe profession. Three professions. Let's assume, you know, because I could talk myself out of anything. I could be like, oh, but then I'd have to blah. But this is sort of the idealized version of three professions that in this alternate universe you have.
A writer, if I had the discipline, like a novelist.
Mm-hmm.
A botanist.
Ooh, I love it.
And like helping people, development strategy. Like, I have friends who do that, and I wish I had the stomach for it.
Is that like life coaching? I feel like I'm saying something very clumsy in relation to this, but
more like on a national scale.
So a life coach for someone important. I'm totally kidding. Great, development strategy. Yeah. Okay. And then final category, let's say three places and times in history. It could be as specific as you want or as sort of general, like an era or a decade or a century. But three places that you're in this sort of safety bubble. So you can go and observe, but you're not going to like die of measles.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting.
Because you could sort of use it to like know the truth about a historical mystery, or it could just be like, you know, oh, I just wanted to see what the dinosaurs looked like.
Yeah, I think they would all be sort of vaguely frontier moments. So I'd like to see sort of the colonization of Australia and what that was like, what the politics of that were like, because, you know, other than sort of taking the land from the indigenous people, you had these people who'd just been shipped out to purgatory or hell, taken away completely to the other side of the world, and having to build a new life. I'd like to see what the medieval period was really like, what they called the Dark Ages.
Mm-hmm.
And then probably, like if you were definitely safe, either Sparta or the Huns. Watch that kind of real military lifestyle, see what that was like.
Okay, I put down Sparta because that happens to be the first thing that you said. Okay, give me a number between 1 and 7.
7.
Okay, great. Certainly Julian can cut out some of this gaping hole of silence I'm about to create, but I also like to use this moment to say that if people would like to find more of you, where can they do so?
Patreon.com/AliceFraser, that's FRASER, or Alliterative on Twitter and Instagram, AlliterAtive. Also, my special Savage is coming out on Amazon Prime in January.
Oh, wonderful.
Yee.
All right, I am very pleased to reveal your 100% guaranteed fictitious MASH future, or your alternate life happening in another dimension. You are, first of all, I want to congratulate you on the beautiful apartment that you have in Soho. What a wonderful place to just get away or work or whatever you want. I certainly, as a writer, I feel that that is a rich environment from which to be inspired. By which to be inspired, I should say. Within the place that you are currently, you also have, and perhaps this is what inspired you to do so much writing and have such enormous discipline, you have this tower room, sort of an attic room, that is just entirely populated by books and ladders and little nooks and comfy places to read. Speaking of, you have the ability to jump into 13 clocks and just be in that world however much you want, whenever you like. You certainly have your unlimited supply of really wonderful Japanese food at your disposal whenever you need. I feel
Amazing.
Like Yeah, you may. Listen, I don't know what's going to happen when you get back from your visit to the Dark Ages. I'm of course, it's going to inform your art, so that will be worthwhile. But you may just need to sort of, you know, just shake that loose a little bit, because from what we hear, it was a pretty intense time. I want you to rest assured that your charming rake is going to stand by gladly to spirit you off for some other wild adventure. And that is your alternate universe, Alice, life.
That is a great life.
You've done well. You've done well.
Almost as good as my real life right now.
Yeah, not quite. And certainly more ridiculous. Well, Alice, I hope that this hasn't soured you on me to the point where I don't end up doing your podcast. I would very much like to continue our conversation. So if it just ends up being at a different time, under different auspices, but very similar auspices, then I'm 100% on board.
Let's do it next week.
Okay. We will see each other in our calendars. Until then, goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you so much for having me.
The show is recorded by me and edited by Julian Burrell. And as always, the JV Club theme song is Back Before We Were Brittle by the amazing Say Hi.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.